KTOO Public Media would like to acknowledge the Hlene Di and the Woosh Kitan of the Occoquan. We are on their ancestral homeland. Our broadcast studios are built on fill that was once tideland and part of what is called the Indian Village. We recognize those families who traveled to and from their homes from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages and whose children played on the beaches and learned to row in the harbor. The families of the Juneau Indian Village, like their ancestors, cherish and depend upon their immediate connection to the waterfront. We'd like to take a moment to say thank you to the individuals who helped us craft our daily land acknowledgement. Gunoshish to Vera Starbird, who planted the idea of making it super place specific. Lillian Petershore, who created so much of the beautiful structure. Ishmael Hope, who gave additional ideas, and Ernestine Hayes, who gave feedback. We are grateful to everyone offering guidance as we grow as an organization.
Hansen Gress, Ka eat with the Shu Yi, we Kashuk are ye tin. Jin Katka Ke Jin Tauk Anakaya Ha Anikach, Gunish Cheesh.
You're tuned in to Juneau Afternoon. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and my next guest will be this Friday's evening at Egan Speaker. Welcome, Jim Bechtal. Hello, Jim.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for being here today. I was wondering if you could introduce yourself to our listeners.
Yeah, I'm Jim Bechtal, and the geologist for the Tongass National Forest. Not geologist in the sense of working with the mines and stuff. Matt Reese in Juneau does that. I work on geohazards, landslides, karst and cave issues, and glacial history and other things, geologic, fossils, mapping. And today is National Fossil Day, by the way.
Happy National Fossil Day.
Exactly.
What got you interested in studying the geology of sea levels and glaciers here in the Tongass?
When I moved here 30-some-odd years ago and started mapping, it became very apparent that there was many places miles inland from the modern shoreline where these shell deposits and the banks of streams and road cuts and things like that. And it was fascinating for me to read up and like, why was that there? I wasn't familiar with that much changing sea level and land interactions. And the more we mapped, the more we found, and it became probably, my wife would say, an obsession for finding these sites across the Tongass, but working both with researchers and through public lectures and stuff like that and getting the public involved, we've found a lot of sites across the Tongass, and now we're able to tell a story from those.
Your talk this Friday is titled "The Glacial and Sea Level History of Southeastern Alaska, an Update on Continuing Research." One of the things I know you want to talk about in your presentation is isostasy. Could you please give us a general overview of what isostasy is?
We're trying to tend to think of the land as being relatively stable that we walk on, when in fact it's incredibly flexible. So as the ice came forward during the last ice age, as the Cordillian Ice Sheet advanced onto the southeast Alaska and grew thicker and thicker, the weight of that ice actually pushed down on the crust. The mantle moves out underneath the crust as the ice moves out. So as the ice moves out, there's a elevated area out in front of the glacier called a forebulge as that moves across the landscape. And eventually the light ice gets to a certain place, and the more ice there is, the more deformation of the land surface. So as soon as melting starts, then the sea invaded that land and the land rose back up. And today we find shells, for instance, at Juneau at Spalding Meadows at about 190 meters or a little over 600 feet in gross position in the muds underneath the meadow. So it's to think about the earth being flexible enough to move hundreds of feet under the weight of ice is hard to understand. And yet these deposits tell us that story.
Would you please talk a little bit about what is the Cordillera and ice sheet?
There was two ice sheets, the Laurentian and the Cordilleran ice sheet. The Laurentian covered most of Hudson Bay, kind of centered at Hudson Bay, and spread across the North America from that way. And ours started from the Coast Range and spread out towards the coast and towards that. And they met basically kind of in a corridor that came down from central Alaska as one ice sheet then at the height of glaciation. And so the whole idea of the peopling in North America and sharing animals back and forth was, when did that gap between the two ice sheets open up relative to what was going on the coast out here? And so understanding the complexity and timing of that has a lot to do with the timing that humans could have reached North America and how we have exchanged animals and stuff through time back and forth.
This is sort of a layperson's question. I understand about rebound and uplift when glaciers retreat, but is there an effect on the Earth's crust when sea levels rise?
Yeah, so when sea levels drop and when sea level rise, that has a huge effect as well. And as all of this glacial sea level changes and stuff come on, that's what we focused on trying to figure out the timing of. One of the other aspects of that is that it's come to light that about 3,000 to 4,000 years after maximum deglaciation starts, where you have the most flexure going on, there's also a lot of volcanic activity at that time. You're opening and closing fissures that allows magma to come to the surface. And so we see a lot of almost immediately post-glacial volcanism, such as Mount Edgecombe and many of the volcanoes and stuff around Ketchikan and south of Craig, Alaska.
Thanks for answering that one. I was wondering if your talk is going to cover your field and lab methods for data collection.
I'll get into that. I'm also going to touch a little bit on cosmogenic or exposure dating, which we've been doing of bedrock surfaces and erratics on ridges to come up with when did the ice leave that boulder sitting there on the landscape. And the results of that combined with kind of studying where these shells have been and that whole story and how they really dovetail together to paint that picture of how rapidly the ice moved back on the landscape.
And will you be talking a little bit about how you analyze the samples that you collect? I heard a funny rumor that sometimes hot dog rollers are used to heat and agitate samples. Is that something that you would use?
No, I haven't heard that.
Okay.
We usually take these samples and wash and screen them and then try to pull out something that's not shell material to date, if we can, out of those samples, which usually you can because they are estuary or shoreline samples. So all of the organics and stuff that would normally be there are still preserved in these muds because the muds are anoxic, nothing rots. Then on the cosmogenic dating, that has to be taken to a lab and very carefully extracted over quite a long period of time. And I have not actually done that analysis. That's done in labs back in, I believe, in Buffalo, New York right now.
What else will you be covering in your talk this Friday?
Changing climate, taking a look at where we might have had fire in our ecology. We might have been quite a bit warmer than we are. I'm going to touch just briefly on we've just started taking a look at these super fine resolution climatic records from speleothems in the caves. So the stalagmites and stalactites carry a record of climate during the time that they were being deposited. And just kind of just on all that aspects, I'll touch a little bit on the cultural history and how that's kind of tied to these shorelines and how we determined when the timing of the forebulge collapse was on the western shore and how that ties into oral traditions as far as the speed with which the water rose. If you're dropping the land at the same time that sea level is rising, the experience on there was a pretty dramatic change in the sea level in one's lifetime.
Mm. Will your presentation include any multimedia elements?
Nope. PowerPoint slides and conversations, and hopefully will spur a lot of questions. I hope to be able to give this information in about 45 to 50 minutes with plenty of time for questions afterwards. I really like having the opportunity to help people understand how their landscape that they live in has evolved, because I think that makes a richer experience for all of us out there when we take a look at that landscape and have a little bit better understanding of how it got to be where it's at.
Well, I like that you're including an element of oral histories into this talk, which sounds very scientific and data-driven, but it's I think with the oral histories as well juxtaposed with the, you know, the hard data, it makes it more a little bit more holistic.
Yeah, the oral traditions of the rising tide puts it back so we know that people were here experiencing this incredibly rapid rise of sea level because of what was going on with the land and the water interactions at that time. You know, and so that definitely puts people at that 11,000 year period, somewhere in there on that landscape, to have experienced that.
How interesting. The talk is this Friday at 7 p.m. via Zoom. Free, but registration is required, and you can find out more at uas.alaska.edu/EganLecture. Jim Bechtold, is there anything else you'd like to share with our audience today?
You could learn how to use flubber to teach isostatic rebound.
I didn't read that in the blurb. Do you want to say more about it?
No, you have to have some kind of good fun things come out of this. You know, actually, I was taught this by classes in Sitka. This is not my original idea. The students and the teachers came up with this and taught me how to use that.
Well, if that doesn't hook in someone who is on the fence about the lecture, I don't know what will. So I look forward to hearing more about flubber on Friday. Thanks so much for speaking with me today, Jim.
Exactly. All right, you have a great afternoon.
You as well.